welcome to all you faithful patrons of Shea Fippy, and welcome to another edition of the Shea Fippy Mob Pod, a podcast you can't refuse, available on the Full Press Radio Network. I am one half of your hosting tandem here at the bar this afternoon. As always, I am Mike DeBate, and I am joined by my cohort in crime. He is the sunny to my Jimmy Whispers, my good friend Thomas Murphy. Murph, we are back at it again, breaking down one of the greatest films of all time and really the standard setter for all of this genre of mafia movies, mob movies, gangster movies, however you want to categorize it. The Godfather always comes back to the original, and we chronicled the first half of the movie in a pretty detailed explanation the last time around. And for those of you that did download the episode, we hope you enjoyed it. We hope you learned a little bit more about the film. Perhaps you learned something you didn't know about the film. And we're back at it today to chronicle the second half, which really, I think, is the crescendo of the movie. You really, really get to the peak in action. And without further ado, we want to kick it off. So, Murph, welcome back to the bar, my friend. Thank you for joining me once again.
Well, thanks for not locking me in, or locking me out, I should say. did you get hate mail? I got hate mail last week.
I didn't. I actually didn't get that much hate mail last week.
I did. I got hate mail.
Please elaborate.
All right. A vast majority, I don't want to say a majority, a vast number of our patrons here at Shea's Bippy were quite upset that we're making them wait an entire week for the second half of the show. How could you do that, Murph? We're sitting there. What? What do you mean, over? It was one of our longest shows to date, you know, chronically just the first half of this film, this great film that you know, we all own on so many different platforms and ways and means, to the point that every time something new comes out, now my wife gives me a dirty look and says, no, no.
Well, I assure you, I am equally as guilty. I own this on VHS. I own it on DVD. I own it on Blu-ray. And I was so tempted to go digital download on this as well. I haven't done that yet, and I'm probably going to cave and do that eventually. But I do own it on major platforms. VHS is locked away. I actually own the old Saga, the chronological version, which
you?
Came in a black sleeve, and I've got
I
that.
Got
that
it.
Is.
Oh, yep. Yeah.
Yeah, it came with the guidebook, which looked like a magazine, and it was. It actually belonged to my dad. And that was one of those things where he handed it down, and I actually had it displayed in my room, you know, when I was
on a shelf,
a teenager,
all by itself.
And into, exactly, it was venerated up there with all the, you could make the argument. Yeah, you could make the argument that that was displayed more prominently than the Bible should have been.
Right,
but,
right next to Clemenza's sauce pot.
Absolutely. Clemenza's sauce pot's up there. You know, it's definitely it's right there. You know, the gold.
Do you have the cookbook?
Godfather Part Two. I'm sorry.
Do you have the cookbook? There's a Godfather cookbook out there. Did you know that?
There is. I have the coffee table book, which is the Godfather Legacy, which was published a few years ago, which is essentially like the Godfather family photo album. And it really does read like a photo album. You see all the pictures from behind the scenes and when they were filming the movie. And then there are pictures that are actually put in there as if this were the Corleone family photo album. So it's interesting. That is my coffee table book. It is out. You know, people do, you know, thumb through it. I kind of have a coronary every time people pick it up. I'm worried someone's going to spill coffee or beer on
white
it or
gloves.
Anything. Exactly. White gloves. You know, you have to hermetically seal yourself before you go out. You know, you view it. But
please
not
step into the decontamination chamber before opening the book and place your white gloves on carefully.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, no question about it. And there are, and it, you know, we'll get into that a little bit toward the end of the show when we talk about the legacy. There were so many. There were actually a lot of merchandise opportunities that were explored that were never really came to fruition. A couple of them did, just weren't marketed properly. So we'll get into that in a little bit. But for those of you that did listen to the show the last time, we really do appreciate it, because it was a long show, and we had to break it up a little bit. As much as we didn't want to have to stop, it was just too much packed into to one episode. So normally we go 2 weeks. Murph and I, you know, abbreviated it and came back on a week, rest, because we definitely wanted to make sure that we chronicle this movie in its entirety, and chronicled it so well for you guys to be able to do it. So in terms of hate mail, yeah, I actually did get, when you said hate mail, I was like, okay, where's he going with this? But I actually did get a couple of pieces of feedback that a lot of people were waiting very patiently to hear the chronicle of the second half of The Godfather. So without further ado, Murph, is there anything you wanted to get to before we get into the action?
No, let's just jump right in, man. Let's get in the car and head to the causeway.
All right, excellent. And that's exactly where we left Michael when we ended last week's show in the first half of The Godfather. Michael had just stood up, shot Saluzzo and McCluskey. He had left Louis' restaurant in the Bronx, which had the best feel in the city, by the way. I have to mention that. And he was now in the getaway car heading for the causeway and assumedly heading for a boat to take him to Sicily and take him safely away, where he could be under the protection of, originally it was supposed to be probably in southern Italy, not quite Sicily yet, but he would eventually find his way to Sicily and the protection of Don Tomasino, who was an emissary of Vito Corleone as well, and a good friend of his, probably the only one he could have trusted to the care of his son, and Sonny actually setting that up and caring and making sure that his brother was going to be properly cared for when he was hiding out in Sicily. But this scene that we had just left, and I know I find myself, and I think, Murph, you probably do as well, that trumpet blare when Michael drops the gun, and it's perfectly timed. You want to thank, Nito Rota and also Francis Ford Coppola as well for timing that perfectly. The gun hits the ground, and you hear that bum, 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 bum. I think every person that watches The Godfather, just, you know, you either pump your fist right alongside it, or you beat to it, or, you know, you maybe even sing along with it when it comes along. But it really does signify the turning point, I think, in the movie. At that moment, Michael is now in the underworld. He is now a part of the seedy part of the Corleone family business,
right.
The part he never wanted to cater to. It's a part he never wanted to participate in, but now he's in it, and he had to do it to avenge the honor of his father. And it is a poignant scene in the movie, but it's also a poignant scene in the making of the movie, and we kind of hinted at this the last time we were on the microphone together. Al Pacino was not the first choice of Paramount. He wasn't even the second or third choice of Paramount. He was the top choice of Francis Ford Coppola. And they were kind of doing this as a favor to Coppola to say, okay, well, if you're going to make the movie, he was already signed on. If they had let him go, there was going to be a real difficult time getting the movie made. So they relented to have Pacino come in. But Paramount was not thrilled with Pacino's casting. And even through the dailies that that Coppola was sending over to Paramount, they were not thrilled with his casting, and they were really ready to pull the trigger, no pun intended, but they were really ready to pull the trigger on firing Al Pacino. And this scene came along. And in an interview that Pacino gave, which was A Godfather, A Look Inside, which anybody that has either the DVD or the VHS or the Blu-ray, look on the special features. This Godfather Look Inside was filmed as they were, it was basically filmed as they were filming Godfather Part 3. And Pacino is interviewed, and he basically said that he was out. He was really coming under the assumption that he was out. He was actually, I remember at one point he said that he was in the makeup room, and he went to use the restroom, and there were two production assistants that were in there that were basically snickering behind his back, having no idea he was in the room with them, and saying, "Oh yeah, that guy, the guy that's playing Michael is gone. He's done. We're basically, you know, we're resigned to it. Somebody else is going to come in and play it." So Pacino was really, really resigned to the fact that he was out, and this scene really saved his job. But I don't know, Murph, if you were aware of this. I did a little digging over the weekend. It wasn't just this scene that saved Al Pacino's job. It actually saved Francis Ford Coppola's job. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that. I knew the other half of this story, but I did not know this. And please, get into it.
Okay, so essentially what had happened with Coppola is Coppola was not really thrilled with having to film scenes of violence, scenes with any type of force. Coppola is a pacifist, and most people would not know that about Francis Ford Coppola with, you know, directing films such as The Godfather and Apocalypse Now. No one would ever think that he was the type of guy that really abhorred violence that much, but it's not something that he was comfortable with and something that he really did not look forward to. The dailies that were being sent to the executives at Paramount were really starting to get under the skin of a lot of these quote-unquote, I don't want to say executives over and over again, because it wasn't just the executives, but they were more pilot people around the executives that were telling the brass at Paramount. Yeah, they were basically telling the people at Paramount, this is boring. No one's going to sit through a three-hour movie like this. This could be condensed into an hour and a half. We need action. We need the guys coming in, laughing hysterically with the Tommy guns, blowing guys away. That's what the audience wants to see. But Coppola had a different vision, which really coincided with what Mario Puzo wanted as author of the novel. So because of the fact that Coppola had so many difficulties with casting, and Paramount was already not thrilled with the casting of Marlon Brando, the casting of Al Pacino. They felt that James Caan was miscast and that his scenes were being cut dramatically, that he should have had more screen time. So there was a lot that was working against Coppola, and his dailies that he was sending in, they were finding were quite boring. At least this is according to the brass at Paramount. Not only was Al Pacino on the verge of being fired, but Francis Ford Coppola was actually being shadowed by a second director, not a second unit director, a second director, someone that would be there right at the, almost like a relief pitcher. And basically, at any moment, Francis Ford Coppola could have been yanked and the new director could have gone right in. Imagine having to do that in your job, sitting there trying to do your job, and there's somebody that's sitting next to you that's ready to just take your place, that's there and waiting for you to go in. Coppola knew that in order to save his job, he was going to have to show some sort of sign of life. And this is the scene that he initially did. He worked with some violence coordinators, believe it or not, that coordinated scenes like this to make it as suspenseful and to make it as realistic to the book as possible. And this is a scene that really was filmed so well. And it really captured the essence of the novel. If you go into the Godfather novel and you read the murder of Sollozzo and McCluskey, it's very close to how it is in the actual book. And I think that makes it work so well. So this scene really saved not only Pacino's job, but it saved Coppola's job as well.
That's an amazing tidbit. That is just, I can't imagine directing a movie in this manner and done this well with somebody hanging over your shoulder the entire way, because you have to. Coppola just seemed to go into this with a vision of epic proportions that he wasn't going to allow somebody to derail, and to continue to do that with the studio hanging on you. And I can't imagine the notes that he was getting back during as he sent dailies in, and just say, no, we're doing it this way. We're doing it this way. I'll be damned if I let them, you know, ruin my movie because they're going to threaten to fire me. I'm just going to keep doing it. Bravo. Bravo.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Exactly. And Pacino chronicles, and he really, Pacino and Coppola have developed such a respect, a reverence for one another, and really a deep friendship as well, but really a respect and a reverence for one another, because they were rogues, and they were essentially guys that had to band together and put their head down, run forward, and break the plane. And that's exactly what they did with this scene. Pacino actually chronicles one of he actually intercepted one of the notes that was intended from paramount to Francis Ford Coppola after they showed the dailies. And it said, regarding Pacino, when's he going to do something? And that was it. That was really
wow.
it. They basically felt that this guy was as deadpan. And we think about the history now of Al Pacino and the filmography. Boring is not a word that you can use to describe Al Pacino's portrayal in most movies. A lot of people call him bombastic. He's been labeled with the overactor, label as well. I happen to enjoy Pacino's style. I think the flamboyance, I think that really feeds into who he is. Pacino actually is nothing like the characters he plays. He's actually very shy, very even sweet and very reserved in real life. And a lot of people would not know that about him. But the characters that he plays are very flamboyant, very over the top, and he does it so well. And I think it's a side that maybe he doesn't cater to in his personal life, and he's able to let that go in his professional life and on camera. But this was the moniker that he was going to be labeled with. He was boring, he was dull, and he was not someone that they wanted to continue having. But this scene really opened the eyes of Paramount. And after this scene, the second director was let go. He was no longer needed, and Al Pacino was now cemented as Michael Corleone. So moving forward, the second half of The Godfather was a lot easier for them to be able to put together, because now they knew that this was going to be their job and that it wasn't up for being lost. So Coppola then transitions this scene. After now Michael is, and getting back into the plot line, after Michael has now murdered the police captain and the quote-unquote underworld leader now, or the underworld director, I should say, is a better word to describe Sollozzo, of guys like Don Barzini and Philip Cattaglia and these heads of the families that were really kind of doing the behest of Sollozzo, because he was the guy that was controlling the poppy fields to process the heroin and be the drug kingpin now in the United States. It now means that Michael has to hide out in Sicily, and it also means a lot of gangland violence was going to erupt as a result of this. This
right.
blew the lid off of organized crime. Having a police captain shot meant that the police were no longer going to protect organized crime. Even if they wanted to, even if they were being paid well to do that, they couldn't ignore the murder of one of their own. So they were going to crack down on all operations that were doing that, and everything essentially that was organized crime was brought to a standstill. And we see a newspaper montage with like an operatic instrumental that's playing in the background, and you see still photos of people being murdered. One little tidbit that I wanted to advise you on is a couple of weeks ago Murph and I chronicled The Untouchables, Brian De Palma's film starring Kevin Costner, Sean Connery. And one of the actual still photos is a real photo of the actual Frank Nitti, who was played by now, unfortunately, the late Billy Drago. He passed away very shortly after Murph and I completed the chronicle that we did of The Untouchables. But one of the still photos is a still photo of the dead body of Frank Nitti. Now, Nitti was actually not thrown off of the building by Elliot Ness. That was done for the movie purposes, and that was done for the character purposes, and was really done well with the movie, but that was not historically accurate. The real Frank Nitti actually shot himself in anticipation of being caught by the police. So one of those still photos, it kind of looks like there's a guy that's slumped against, it looks like a chain link fence, and his head is down, and you can see a wound, his face covered in blood. It's a pretty gory shot. That is the actual Frank Nitti. So I didn't know if anybody was aware of that. All these movies kind of tie together somehow.
Yep.
So that's the tie-in between The Godfather and The Untouchables. But this really is a transition to the movie. And originally there was supposed to be an intermission due to the 3-hour length of the movie and the height of that type of a scene where you're on high from Michael, committing the murders and avenging his father. Coppola thought that it would be a good idea to have an intermission put into that movie. Essentially, Paramount overruled him, and Coppola did relent on that. He didn't push it. But originally, that was supposed to be an intermission. So we start to see the transition of the movie and how that's going to work, and Michael now being a part of the Corleone family. In terms of the intermission, Murph, what, I guess I'm going to put you on the spot here, and I'm going to ask you, do you feel that the movie would have had a greater impact if they did have that old school type intermission like a lot of old movies did, where, you know, The Sound of Music had one and
yep.
Gone with the Wind had one? And
I
do you
do.
Think that would have heightened it, or do you think that they were better off editing it the way they did, the full 3 hours straight through?
No, I think it would have worked much better with the intermission. I really do. You know, just to take a moment. I mean, God, man, that was some of the best sex on screen ever filmed. Everybody needed a cigarette at that point in time. They needed to walk out and get a drink and do something. And just to take that in after the slow buildup that went on throughout the first portion of this film, I think it would have worked fantastically. It's really hard to sit there and say that. You know, it's almost nitpickish when you're talking about the greatest film that has ever been made, and you know, this is the hill that I'll die on. But no, I think, you know, just to be able to walk out and then you know, hear that bell to run back and see people trying to run back to their seats, which was, you know, in a more civilized time where people would have said, yeah, I was sitting there and gone back to their regular seats. But just to get back in there, you for those of you that are younger and you don't remember intermissions, the theater would ring the bell because, you know, the second part of the film was about to start. Yeah, I think it would have worked fantastically. Nowadays, we can all hit pause and go out and do something. You know, women head to the powder room or whatever. But back then you couldn't. And I think an intermission right there would have been really perfect.
Yeah, I mean, I actually agree with you. I think that the intermission is an lost art in a lot of movies,
yeah.
And I think it really would have worked well with this one because there
it should be brought back. It should be brought
yeah.
back. Nobody should have to
I
sit
agree.
Through 3 hours of Avengers and you know, with missing something. No, the intermission's coming up.
I completely agree, and I would be all for that as well. And I think that it really would have worked well in a film like this, especially with the rising and the falling action of, you know, everything that happened. It really is a movie that does ebb and flow when it comes to the action, and the action comes at times where sometimes you anticipate it, sometimes you don't, but with this, it was really building toward that moment, and I think there was such, you're right, there was such a release at that point after, you know, the murder of McCluskey and Saluzzo, you know, bringing this back in. So we see the newspaper montage, and that continues to go through, and the newspaper montage, I think, brilliantly ends with a small article that's in the paper that shows syndicate big shot Vito Corleone returns home from the hospital, and at that point, you know that the Don is now okay. He's able to return, but he's not in great shape. I mean, they're still transporting him with an IV. They're transporting him in a hospital. He's not coming home, walking home with his hat in hand and waving to the crowd. He's still in pretty rough shape. He's still convalescing, but because of the gangland wars and the gangland violence, the Corleone family knows that they can do very little to protect him at this point, so they want to have him in his home base where they can control the security and everything that's going on around him. And you see Vito return home. The whole family's there, Sonny and his children, Tom Hagen, Fredo, Connie is there as well with her husband, and everybody is kind of, you know, rallying around the Godfather coming home, and the bodyguards are carrying Vito in his stretcher upstairs. And this is something I know you know, Murph. I can hear the laughs, and I think we're going in the same spot. I'm going to let you take this tidbit because I think people have heard enough of my voice already. But this is typical Marlon Brando. This is typical of what he did, and this was his idea. So go ahead and those guys that were carrying him up the stairs, they got a surprise while they were carrying him up a rather steep staircase on the set of the Corleone family home.
It is a very steep staircase. And Brando is a notorious practical joker. Nobody, you know, people out there, if you don't know this about, he would do anything to get a rise out of people, make them laugh. You know, there's a story in about the movie he did with Matthew Broderick,
Freshman.
The freshman, thank you very much. And where Broderick said, yeah, I wasn't really expecting Brando to slap me there. Brando would just give him a smack. But during the scene in the filming of it, he got a bunch of lifting plates, York plates, for those that don't know, are for weightlifting. And he put them underneath him in the on the stretcher. So that stretcher weighed about 550 pounds. And these guys are trying to lug him up these stairs, and he's doing everything he can not to crack up while these guys are trying to pick him up and carry him up the stairs. It's really cruel, but it's funnier than hell. And he said they had to film it like two or three times because these guys kept dropping the stretcher on the way up. There was one interview where we're lucky we didn't have to rebuild the staircase after that, because Brando was so laden with weightlifting plates that the guys just kept dropping the stretcher that he was on, and they couldn't figure out why he was cracking up until he you know pulled back the sheet, and there was an extra 200 pounds there. But that's why you started talking, and I couldn't stop giggling because I think it's the funniest thing ever. I would have loved to have worked with Brando. Working with somebody like this who just, you know, on a film set that has gone through all of the trials and tribulations that this one had, you needed moments like this, and that was one of them. I also heard that his scene later on that we'll get to in the in the tomato garden was also a bit ad-libbed. It was fantastic. It was great. And there's my bit of rambling, and we'll get back to Mike where we really should be.
No, it's not rambling at all. I think it's really you absolutely nailed it when you talk about Brando and the genius of Brando. And this movie is really a masterclass in the genius of Marlon Brando. I mean, he's had a reputation of not really preparing for his roles or anything like that, and that's always been the knock on Brando. But
cue cards and
what. Yep. When you see what this guy is able to turn it on, you talk about, you know, Murph and I are obviously in the sports realm, so we hear about guys that, you know, really may give like a half-hearted effort, but they turn it on when you need to. I think LeBron is one of those guys that a lot of people say that, oh, well, he doesn't give any effort, but when he turns it on, that's when really you see the brilliance of who the guy is. And I think in a lot of ways, I think that can be said about Brando and his acting. He was a notorious prankster. A scene that we chronicled the last week when we talked about the first half of The Godfather, when he slaps Johnny Fontaine and he goes, "You're gonna act like a man," and he goes, that was ad-libbed. That was not part of the original script. Brando smacked Al Martino in his face a couple of times. And a matter of fact, the camera pans toward Robert Duvall. And Robert Duvall is laughing. He's just laughing uncontrollably. That's a real laugh from Robert Duvall. That is not Tom Hagen laughing at the character. That's Robert Duvall laughing at Brando. And the camera captured
as
it.
As he's mocking him.
And he kept it in.
Yep.
And he kept it in. You know, in the novel, he yells and berates Johnny Fontaine, but he doesn't actually slap him or really make fun of him.
Right.
And cry like he did. He does that. That's all off the top of his head. And he did that to try to get a natural reaction out of him. Even the stray cat, which everybody assumes the cat is a part of a Godfather lore, where he's petting the cat. That was a stray that just happened to show up on set. Brando picked him up, put it on, and total animal lover. He picked him up and put him on his lap and kept him in there. The Corleone family wasn't supposed to have a cat. That was never part of the original script. He just found a stray on the set and said, you know, I like him and I'm going to keep him in there. And Coppola
actually
wanted to do the best he could for his star and keep him happy.
I am not a cat person at all. We have two cats. Mm-hmm. The reason that we have a cat to begin with is because of my wife pulling the Corleone card. And I'm like, I hate cats, man. I can't stand you. Who has a cat? And she looked at me and she actually said, Don Corleone has a cat. Because I've made her watch this movie so many. I'm like, all right, you can have a cat.
And Murph Cave. And, you know, and how could you not? I mean, how can you argue with that? It's good enough
yep,
for
you
the
can't.
Don. It's good enough
you
for
can't.
The Murph. I like it. I absolutely like it. I didn't know that about you, my friend. Oh. That's great. See, we're all about opening up here on the Shape of the Mob.
Sooner or later, your wife will pull a go to the mattresses moment. And
yep.
if you know, whether they like the film or not, my wife, every time she sees this come on the TV, she goes shopping. I'll see you later. I'm going shopping.
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly.
Because for some reason, this movie does not resonate with women the way it does with men. And I'm sorry if you think that's a terrible generalization. It's true. Women do not look at this film the way men do. There are women out there who do, but on a whole, they don't. And my wife is one of those ones that doesn't. And will do, because she knows that she will be here for, 6 hours. Because I don't do this on, halfway. I'm going 1, 2, and 3. I'm going, the saga. The saga is free on Netflix, so I'm doing it that way and getting ahead of ourselves again. So go ahead.
True.
That's how I got
really
my cat.
Is. No, it's true, and it really is. And it is part of the legacy of this film. You mentioned Go to the Mattresses, and we'll get into that and how that's really become a part of the lexicon of American, slang and really the English language in the United States. I think, so many scenes and so many lines are iconic when it comes to this movie. But in this scene, once the Godfather is up the stairs and once they've, pulled the curtain back on, the lead weights that were hidden in the beneath the blankets of Don Corleone, we see the Don now. He's settled in. His family comes in. His grandchildren have come in. They've made him cards, and they're all things. And you really get the family sense. But it comes back to business very quickly when you see Michael and Tom, when you see Sonny and Tom and Fredo and Clemenza and Tessio in the room, and they're now going to talk business with the Don, with their father, and bring him up to speed on exactly what's been going on while he's been convalescing in the hospital. One scene, this is a very, very poignant scene in the movie, and I think a lot of people probably gloss over it, but this scene sets up so much in the movie that's about to happen. And it really is, if you really pay close attention to this scene in terms of the character development and how it's going to shape the things to come, it's amazing. It really is how important this scene is to the movie. And I really didn't realize that for a long time until I started to really delve into the history of this movie and the character development of this movie. And this scene really does. Carlo is Connie's husband. Carlo is shut out of the family meeting.
All family business.
With the men in the room. Carlo is essentially seen, and this is very briefly seen, where Connie is in the kitchen with her mother and Sandra, who is Sonny's wife, and Teresa, who is Tom Hagen's wife, and they're preparing dinner, and they're just going about their business. And Carlo is just sitting against the wall after being basically asked to leave the room by Sonny. And that's really at the behest of the Godfather. The Godfather never really trusted Carlo. He said to Tom Hagen at the beginning, where, Tom Hagen said to him, he says, "Your new son-in-law, we're going to give him something important." And the Don said, "Never. Give him a living, but never discuss the family business with him." And Sonny always had that predereliction of mistrust when it came to Carlo. He knew what his ultimate motives were. It wasn't for the good of the family. It was for the good of himself. He wanted to marry into the family to be something more important than really what he was. And he is banished from the room, and Carlo's sitting against the wall.
Well, Sonny introduced them.
Exactly. Sonny did introduce him. That comes out in The Godfather Part 2, which not a lot of people really know. There's an end scene, a flashback scene where Sonny introduces Carlo. And I think at that point he could see through Carlo. And I think initially what happened is he saw a guy that was kind of like him, fun-loving, and probably,
he's one of the guys from the hood that Sonny liked to hang out with from the old neighborhood. That he still kept in touch with, and he came to the realization over time that Carlo's a scumbag, and it doesn't matter. This is why he came here to be, he married my sister to become part of the family. He treats her like garbage, which in turn is actually probably the way Sonny treated his wife, with the exception of the physical and emotional abuse. You know, he was out there screwing around. That was the way things were, I guess. And but that wasn't, you know, you weren't supposed to do that to his sister. You're not supposed to treat
exactly.
his sister like that way.
Yeah, that was a do as I say, not as I do. And I think that Sonny saw that side of Carlo, where Carlo was using his bookmaking, you know, business to sort of, you know, push his weight around and make it seem like he was something a lot more important in the family than what he was. And
you know,
we will flush
is?
Out.
Yep.
Yeah. And we will flush out the real disdain that Sonny had for Carlo in just a little bit. But Connie looks at Carlo and says, "What's the matter with you? You know, like, what, you know, you look so down. You look at her," and then he just looks at her and says, "Shut up and set the table," which is, you know, it really is a sign of the times in terms of, you know, just how, you know, the relations between, you know, husband and wife and how that worked out. But we'll get into that in a minute. But essentially, there is a cutaway scene shortly after that where you see Sonny and Tom, and they're filling the Godfather in on what happened, how... And Tom Hagen really kind of takes the lead on this and says that, you know, the police are cracking down on all their on their organization because of what happened. Sonny fills in the Godfather that he's going to be sending Fredo out to Las Vegas, you know, Fredo needs to rest, and he's still dealing with the trauma of being the one that was there when his father was shot, and his own responsibility and his own guilt for not being able to do more for his dad and help him out in his time of need. So Fredo, you see him kind of like slump over and give a real, like, you know, kind of sheepish smile, like, "Yeah, I'm going to go learn the casino business," you know, like, "Well, that's it. That's what I am now. I'm just kind of like the lackey of the family, and I'm going to go out and, you know, and do my own thing." And, you know,
the
so that way I'm
typical
not around.
Middle child syndrome.
Exactly. And
you know?
I'm going to go out so that way I can't cause any more problems for the family. We're going to send him out to Las Vegas where he can't, you know, where he's safe. And he can't, you know, cause any more problems for the
Bangkok
for the family.
Waitresses.
Exactly. Yep. Two at a time. As a matter of fact, you know, we'll learn from Mo Green. But in any case, the Godfather is looking, and he's barely able to speak. And Marlon Brando really does play this very well. And you hear him wheezing, and he's trying to say something that initially is inaudible, but it really does come out when everybody in the room quiets down, and his question to everybody is, "Where's Michael?" And you see a look between James Caan and Robert Duvall where they look at each other, and the Godfather's noticing that. He's noticing that the two guys are looking at each other, and he's like, "Something wasn't told to me." And that's when Tom Hagen leans in and says, "It was Michael who killed Sollozzo, but he's safe, and he's going to work to pay you back." And at that moment, you just see the Godfather's mood slump.
Right.
And he waves off, and he just wants everybody out of the room at that point, and he wants to be alone. And you can see the disappointment on the look of the Godfather's face, where he wasn't able, and you can see the guilt in the Godfather's face and just the resignation to the point where my youngest son is now involved in this too.
Right.
And that's not what I wanted for him. And this is fleshed out in a later scene, which I think is one of my favorite scenes in all of movies, which is a scene between Michael and his father in the garden, which we'll get to in a little bit. But the Godfather shuns everyone out of the room. And at that moment, you see the scene transition to Tom and Sonny leaving the room. And Sonny is basically hot-headed. He's not taking this sitting down. He wants to bring the pride back to his father's eyes. And to do that, he feels that he's got to take out one of the mafia family heads, and that's Don Philip D'Italia, who is really sort of like the lower level of the heads of the five families. D'Italia is more of a, well, lack of a better term, we hear the Don tell him later, D'Italia's a pimp. He really is. He's the one that's really responsible for a lot of the brothels and a lot of he's essentially a sex trafficker, I guess you'd probably say, is probably the best way to, you know, to put it. He's not the more powerful of the family heads. It's really Vito and Don Barzini who really is kind of like the chief rival to Don Corleone, where Tattaglia's always been lower level, but because he attached himself to Sollozzo, he gained a little bit more prominence. And Sonny wants to go after D'Italia. He wants to bring him down. He feels this is going to make his father happy, and it's going to bring pride back in, and it's going to show his dad that he can handle things and that he's, you know, the the every bit of the leader that he ever wanted it to be. And Tom tries to talk him down off the ledge. He says, look, it's not the right time. You can't just do this. You can't act off of impulse. And Sonny is still being very hot-headed, and he yells at Tom and says, God damn it, if I had a wartime consigliere, he says, I won't be in this shape. Pop at Jenko and look what I got, which is a reference to the Godfather's consigliere, Jenko, who was in a deleted scene in the original cut of the movie where the Don and his boys, including Michael, go and they pay their respects to his dying consigliere, which anybody that's seen The Godfather Part 2, if you're familiar with Frankie Carbone from Goodfellas, it's the same actor that plays, right? Not in The Godfather 1, but in The Godfather Part 2, that's the guy that is kind of, mirroring and shadowing De Niro around a little bit. That's Jenko. That's the guy that ends up being his consigliere. In the Godfather film, in the original, there is a scene with Brando taking his sons to go visit him on his deathbed. And that scene was cut for continuity reasons and also for time reasons, but it really is a very good scene. If anybody wants to check out the deleted scenes on The Godfather, if you own any of the
platforms, you can find them on YouTube.
Available on all of them. Absolutely. And they are available on YouTube as well if you wanted to go in and take a look at those. But Sonny is now at the table, and he's sitting at the head where his father would normally be. And they're having Sunday dinner, and Carlo makes a reference about wanting to do more for the family. And Sonny just looks back at him and says, we don't discuss business at the table. And it's a repeat of a line that Connie had just fed to him where he was talking about, the family business, and he was talking about things and just blurting out, stuff that really should have been, really is not dinner table conversation.
Right.
But Sonny, is showing his immaturity as a leader, and Connie kind of brings him back into to where she says, Pop would have never said that, and you go, Carlo makes a reference to him like, oh, shut up, and he looks at her and he says, don't you ever tell her to shut up, and that really, I think, foreshadows
and,
a lot
and
of
his
the,
mother,
this is important.
This is important. His mother steps on him and says, don't get involved, you're not supposed to get involved between a wife and her husband.
Because
that's serious old school stuff. And that's when he comes out with, we don't talk about stuff. We don't talk about business at the dinner table.
Yeah.
Using
that
as an excuse. Right now, Sonny is just thoroughly disgusted by his brother-in-law and can't believe that, he set these two up to begin with. And he knows that, He's trying to let him know that this is it for you. This, you are never going to be anything more than you are now. And that brings us to, the scene that I believe we are about to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And what that does is it does, put into.
Sorry, did I make you skip around?
No, it's okay. No, that's fine. The Godfather essentially is seen in the Fredo goes upstairs and he sits with his dad and his father's just staring off into space and you can tell that's where his head is. His head is with his son, Michael, and he wants to make sure that not only is he safe, but he's also so concerned that Michael might be in danger. This was sort of the gem of his eye, and he loved Sonny. He loved Fredo. Even Tom in his own way loved Connie, but Michael was always his golden child and the one that he thought was going to be the savior of the family. And it transitions very nicely. We see the Godfather staring off into space and they play the Godfather love theme as it transitions to a countryside in Sicily. And Michael is walking through the countryside in Sicily with his two bodyguards, Fabrizio and Carlo, C-A-L-O, not Carlo, but Carlo, C-A-L-O. And the two of them are walking through. Don Tomasino, who is now in charge of Michael's safety, drives up and says, it's very dangerous. You shouldn't be walking out here. And he tells him that he's walking to Corleone. And he wants to go to his father's city where his father was born and his family, the Andolini family, which was initially the last name of the Corleone family that was given to them at Ellis Island. And we'll get into that when we chronicle The Godfather Part 2. But you start to see that Michael is settling into life in Sicily. He's with his bodyguards. He's essentially walking through, and he is now a part of Sicilian life for the time being while Sonny transitions and tries to get him back to America. America, which is really, and that's one of the questions that Michael asks Don Tomasino. And I love how the Sicilian scenes were kept true. They were kept, all the dialogue is in a Sicilian dialect.
Yep.
Which when I like to show off, I like to turn off the subtitles on the bottom of the screen, and I love to be able to translate to people exactly what they're saying. The translation is usually pretty good, but there are some elements of
there's some words that needed to be polished up or changed, for lack of a better word.
And the actual
just so it read correctly.
Yeah, the actual subtitles are a little bit more done in the King's English than actually what is the literal translation of what we see in Sicilian. Michael asks Don Tomasino, and, what did Sonny say when I can return? And he says, oh, no, not yet. And he doesn't even give him a time frame. He just says, no, not yet. It's way too dangerous. So Michael kind of shakes his head and realizes, well, it's not going to be anytime soon. So I better just resign myself. And he walks, and he wants to walk with his bodyguards to Corleone. And there's montages where we see, his bodyguards with him, and one of them, one of them yells out, to some of the American soldiers that are still there in the aftermath of World War II, take me to the American GI, Clark Gable, be there. It's really, that's a foreshadowing of Fabrizio and the treachery that he's about to commit with Michael. That's all he wants. He wants to go to America. He wants to make a living in America and be something bigger than just a local bodyguard for the local mafia hood here in Sicily, whereas Carlo seems very resigned to his lifestyle and is kind of content and very happy with it. But Fabrizio wants more, and that's one of the reasons why he was more corruptible in a scene we're going to chronicle in a little bit. But we see Michael go to a cafe, an outdoor cafe, and he's essentially sitting down for what will be just like a refreshing drink with his bodyguards. And he's talking about a young woman that he saw early on. And we do see this scene where Michael was walking through the countryside and immediately he's hit by the thunderbolt, which is very Italian. I will say that. That's one thing that, my uncles and my older uncles and aunts and everything would always ask me after I went out on a date with a girl or whatever. They'd ask, oh, you hit by the thunderbolt. No bull in it. And I would say, well, and they'd say, no. You would know if you were hit by it. So Michael was immediately hit by it. This young woman that is just a beautiful young lady wearing a purple dress and she looks like she's tending to, young children. They're in her care. And he's so struck by it that by the time these guys get to the cafe, that's all they can talk about. And the owner of the cafe comes out and he sits down with them and he's having a conversation. And they're talking about this young lady and he seems intrigued by it. And then they start to describe her. And all of a sudden, the smile disappears from this man's face, and he becomes enraged. He gets up, and in Italian, no, non ci sono queste ragazze, and that basically means, in this town, no, there's no girl like that in this town.
Right.
And Fabrizio realizes what's going on. Carlo's, I think, having a little bit too much wine at the table. He's not really following.
Yeah, Carlo's just Carlo, He's just
He's having a grand old time. He's like, hey, I'm not going to get a chance to rest, so I'm going to sit down. I'm going to have some wine. I'm going to just relax. But Fabrizio realizes what might be going on here. So Fabrizio downs his drink and tells Michael, come on, we got to get out of here. And Michael just looks at him like, what's going on? And he says, Sofia, meaning that that's his daughter. And Michael just kind of closes his eyes, nods his head, and he tells Fabrizio, and he goes, chiamato, which means call him. And Fabrizio's trying to tell him, no, what the hell are you talking about? He's going to come back. He's going to kill you. And he says, no, chiamato. And you see Michael's personality has completely, completely changed from when we first saw him. Fabrizio grabs the gun, which I love. He grabs the gun. He's not going to go in there without being armed because he knows what could possibly happen. And Vitelli, which is the name of the gentleman, comes out with, presumably, you got to assume that these two are his sons. And he comes out, he's reluctant, you can hear things banging in the background. He is really, really angry because he's thinking that this guy wants to get his daughter into bed, and that's it, that's all he wants, and
right.
he's just this hood that I can't stand. Michael realizes that he has disrespected him, and that's not what his intention was. And Michael wants to speak to Vitelli and smooth the situation over. And this is originally this was written in Sicilian. And if you take a look at the scene in the novel, Michael does not have Fabrizio translate for him. Michael speaks Sicilian fluently. Al Pacino did not speak Italian well at all. He tried memorizing his lines and just could not do it. It didn't come across authentic enough
right.
to pass off. So it was actually Pacino's idea, and he says, well, why don't I have one of the bodyguards translate it for me? Maybe it'll work out better. Coppola loved the idea, and I think it was actually superior to what you saw in the novel. It made Michael a fish out of water, but
I want to ask you something.
In his leadership. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to ask you something. I heard that Puzo's Italian was actually terrible
in the novel.
It's almost like, you know, reading Klingon. Is that true?
Yeah, it really is.
I grew up in Middletown, Connecticut, where you have to know Italian. It is. It's a prerequisite at you know, Catholic schools. It's even taught. And so I understand it when it's spoken to me. If you're an
yep.
Italian grandmother and you're yelling, I understand it fluently.
Right.
But no, I can't read it or anything. So I wasn't sure. So that's true. The Italian in the book is terrible.
Yeah, the Italian in the book is actually, it's a very guttural, lower level Sicilian dialect, I guess is the best way for me to put it. It would be the equivalent of slang English, whereas if you speak a very guttural, slangy type English, this would really be what a very guttural Southern Italian dialect would be. Puzo, and a lot of that is really not so much Puzo, it's really just the dialect that they would have spoken, but a lot of it is phonetically spelled in order so that way people could really understand how these terms were pronounced. There is not a lot of actual Italian prose in the Godfather novel. He translates it into English so people can read it. But in terms of what the Sicilian translation would be, yeah, it is. It's a very, very guttural, part of that. And Puzo would be the first to admit, posthumously, obviously, but Puzo would be the first to admit that his Italian wasn't as strong as it needed to be. That was one of the areas he really needed to research going into this novel. It wasn't something where he was able to fit into it. But grammatical Italian and scholars of the language would look at this and they would cringe with every breath in their body because it's so opposite of what the Italian language really should be and how it should be spoken. Even in the movie, Al Lettieri has a very guttural Sicilian dialect that's very difficult to understand for grammatical Italian. I understood it because my family is from the South and it's close to Sicily. My family is not Sicilian, but it is close enough to Sicily where I could get by with a lot of what he was saying. That's why when I chronicled the story last week, I used to translate that scene for my friends all the time. They would wonder what he's saying because you couldn't turn on subtitles for that scene. It was done for a reason that way, and I could translate it fluently. So that's a good transition into that in terms of some of the Italian that you see in the Sicilian montage. But Michael shows his leadership, I think, in this for the first time, where he demands that Fabrizio bring the older gentleman back out, and he wants to have a talk with him. And through Fabrizio, he tells him that he's an American hiding in Sicily. He gives him information that normally a guy that really didn't care would not bring forward. And he lets Vitelli know that he knows he means no disrespect. I saw your daughter. I just think she's beautiful. I would like to meet her with all respect from your family, under the supervision of your family. I'm not going behind your back. My intention is not to woo her or get her into bed. My intention is to be honorable in possibly asking for your daughter's hand in marriage. And he even says that. If anybody knew what I was telling you, your daughter would lose a father instead of gaining a husband. And Fabrizio looks at him like, isn't so, what are you nuts? You're going to actually say that to him? And he tells him, tell him what I told you. And Vitelli you know, grabs his suspenders and he just kind of resigns himself to the fact that, you know, this young man is not the disrespectful creature that maybe I thought he was. And he relents and he invites him to his home in Sicily, in the hills of Sicily on a Sunday for dinner. And you see Michael show up. This is a huge deal. The whole family is there. And, you know, typical Sicilian, you know, typical old school Italian, Michael's sitting at one end of the table. Apollonia is sitting at the other side of the table. They don't have much interaction. Michael brings her a gift. Apollonia actually has to look at her mother for permission to accept it and open it. I mean, this is old school courting here. You had to really want it back in the day. You had to really know.
You had to work for it.
You had to put in a lot of
effort. You had to put in a lot of work,
even when they're supposedly just taking a harmless walk and getting to know one another and assumingly talking. You see the scene where Michael and Apollonia are walking, and you know, just a few steps behind are this coalition of old ladies that's there to keep their eye on them, and that, of course, you know, Michael's bodyguards with the shotguns are there as well. So Michael wasn't going to get away with anything, whether it be with the guys with the shotguns or whether it be with the old ladies watching. This was under strict
supervision. I'd rather
face
the guys with the shotguns. Believe me, I know the gaggle of little old Italian ladies. No, I've been there. Yeah. Been there.
Absolutely. And you see, so Michael is settling into his life in Sicily. And it almost looks like he's settling into a life that he believes is never going to end. This is how he's going to be for quite a while. And if he does get back to the United States, it's going to be, you know, having Apollonia as his wife on his arm and being his Italian mafia wife, basically, for lack of a better term. And this is how he's going to live his life. The transition back to America is interesting because it transitions with Kay Adams arriving at the Corleone family compound. And she comes out and she's greeted at Tom by the gate. And Tom basically says to her, Kay, you should have called. What are you doing here? And she's trying to reach Michael. And you can really see the desperation and the despair in her face. Diane Keaton really plays this role well because she's such a fish out of water with this family, doesn't understand the Sicilian-Italian tradition. And all she's trying to do is just reach her boyfriend, the guy that she went to college with, the one that she was going to start a life with, who essentially shunned her aside after his father was the attempted murder of his father. And she tries to get a message to him, and Tom basically says, well, look, I can't accept that. In a court of law, they can prove I have knowledge of his whereabouts, and they're trying to protect his identity, and they're trying to protect his whereabouts. So Kay at this point has almost transitioned into an afterthought, and she's no longer going to be in Michael's plans. And you start to see the switch of how the Godfather's, you know, life has changed now, with Sonny being more of the active head of the family and the Godfather still convalescing, and Tom taking a more active role in advising Sonny in terms of the best things to do. We transition to a scene now where, and this is a scene that I think we had started to go down, but we had gotten sidetracked with the Sicilian coda, and that is a scene where Connie picks up the phone. She's home. She's pregnant with her first child.
Right.
And she picks up the phone and is the voice of a woman on the other end. And she basically tells her, is Carlo there? And, oh, well, you know, this is a friend of Carlo's. Tell him I can't make it until later. And we later find out that this is a setup, but it's enough to get Connie's blood boiling. And she goes into Carlo, who's getting ready, assumingly it looks like he's getting ready for a date, and most likely he probably was going to see this woman, but he told her to call the house for all due purposes to get Connie up, to get Connie up and upset. And, you know, she sees this blatant disregard for her own respect. Carlo has essentially no respect for her any longer. She's just there, and she's just
his horse. Even call him at the house now.
Exactly. And, you know, and there's a scene where Carlo and her go back and forth, and they yell, and Connie starts breaking things in the house, and, you know, she has a tantrum. She really, really goes into a tantrum, and it leads into one of the more violent scenes in in The Godfather, and I will get into
history.
You know, a little bit, and really in movie history.
Yeah.
And a scene that was inspired by another classic, which had just been filmed just a few years earlier. But prior to this, we flush out the big reason why Sonny is so disdainful of Carlo. And it's a scene where Sonny is fooling around with Lucy Mancini, who's one of Connie's friends, one of her bridesmaids at the wedding. And he comes downstairs and he's basically done his thing with Lucy in the apartment. And he says, "I'm going to go see my sister." And Sonny goes over to his bodyguards and has them take her to Connie's apartment, to Connie and Carlo's apartment. And Connie comes in and she's got a welt on the side of her face and she looks like she's been roughed up a little bit. And the fact that she's been roughed up a little bit is something that does not sit well with Sonny. And Sonny needs no explanation as to how she got this way. He bites his knuckle and Connie pleads with him, "No, don't. It was my fault. I started it." She's trying not to bag Carlo, because she knows Sonny's temper and she knows he'll take it to the next level, and she'd rather be a battered wife than a widow. And at that point, Sonny tries to calm her down. He says, "I'm just going to go get a doctor. I'm going to get somebody to come and look at you." And Sonny leaves, and he finds Carlo in front of his bookmaking business, sitting there nonchalant, like nothing is wrong. Like,
which is the stoop.
You know, exactly. And he sits on the stoop, and Sonny gets out and fires a broomstick handle, which, by the way, was not part of the original script. These two
right.
did not
we,
like
we,
one another.
We went all
went
over
that
last week.
Night, and he fires a broom handle at him, and it's a pretty brutal, you know, beating scene where Sonny just beats the hell out of Carlo, kicks him in the face, kicks him in the ribs, and says, "If you touch my sister again, I'll kill you."
Yep.
That's what makes this scene so much of a bold setup, where I had, you know, mentioned before that, you know, The Godfather was where Sonny had, you know, essentially been the victim of a setup.
That's it.
This was in retaliation to that scene. Carlo had basically set up Sonny. At that moment, when Sonny had humiliated him and kicked him and left him essentially wet in a gutter
in front of all the people that he had been trying to build up some respect
exactly,
for all this time.
Exactly, in front of everybody that he did business with. Now this essentially ruined him. It made him look terrible. And he was not able to save face anymore. Carlo was really, really angry. And he arranges to set up Sonny. And this was part of the setup. He beats Connie, who's pregnant and just looking so disheveled and so disgusted. And you don't actually see him hit. And I think it actually does work better for the scene where see Carlo enter the bathroom. He kicks the door in and you just hear this whacking sound, which you can essentially, you know, put the two... You can essentially put the pieces together that
he's
hitting her with the
belt
that he's now taken off. And, you know, exactly. And he's just, this scene was actually one of the scenes that Coppola actually had to work with a violence coordinator as well. He was not comfortable doing this scene at all.
God,
Talia Shire is his sister. And naturally, it was something very difficult for him to even film a scene where his sister was being physically abused. So he actually did work with a violence coordinator. He actually rehearsed it with his nephew Gio and Talia, you know, and his nephew Gio was the one that was, you know, coming in and hitting her with the belt, and Talia was breaking all the bric-a-brac around her, and so it was interesting the way the scene kind of came down, but it did also lead to some of the negativity that you see in the next scene, where Sonny gets a phone call from Connie, presumably on the hide of Carlo, telling him that Carlo has beat her, and you see the rage in Sonny's face.
Yeah.
Puts down the phone, yells "son of a bitch" a couple of times, gets into his car, which is, by the way, if I ever hit the lottery, I am buying a refurbished version of this. I absolutely love
that car.
The 1941 Lincoln Zephyr, which is just, if you are a car buff, I mean, come on. I mean, that was like my dream car growing up and seeing that. That car is unbelievable. The grill with the just awesome.
Yeah.
Just really, really awesome car. And he gets into it, and he's heading for, you're assuming that he's heading for Connie's apartment. He was going to go check and see how she's doing In the novel, it does flesh out that he's not going to kill Carlo at that moment. He's more concerned with his sister, and he's going to get to Carlo eventually. I mean, and you know that there's no chance that Carlo's going to live through this, but his main
right.
goal right now is to take care of his sister and get her back to the hospital, to get her back to the house where she can be cared for by her mother and everybody around her. So James Caan is Sonny now, is in the car. He's driving now. And well, another little tidbit that I picked up, while Sonny is driving in his car, where he's driving toward the causeway on his way to pick up Connie, he's got the radio on, and you can hear a ball game in the background. Anybody that is familiar with baseball will know the game that he's listening to. And it's the October 3rd, 1951 radio broadcast of Russ Hodges calling the Dodgers versus the Giants playoff.
Yep.
Which is about a half inning before Bobby Thompson shot heard around the world and Russ yelling, "The Giants won the pennant! The Giants won the pennant!" That's the game he's listening to. And that was at the behest of James Caan, actually. He was such a big baseball fan, and he had loved that and says, imagine being able to listen to that live. He had suggested that to Coppola. It fit well enough in the timeline where they could do it.
Yep.
So he put that in there, and that was his nod to James Caan. So Caan got a chance to listen to that as his really last act on earth, really, with Sonny Corleone. He's listening to that game, and he drives up to the toll booth, and everybody pretty much knows, anybody who's seen The Godfather knows what's coming next. One of the more brutal murder scenes, I think, in movie history, and was really inspired. You talk about violence.
It's a movie to this. It's a scene so graphic to this day. It gets edited on free television. They don't show the final spray of bullets as he's lying there. They edit that out. That's how graphic
it
really is.
Exactly. And Sonny is murdered and is brutally murdered, shot so many times. James Caan would later describe that he was fitted with 147 squibs to the point where a equipment guy was actually rigging him up with the squibs and said, "I've never put this many squibs on a person before in my life." To which Caan replied to him, "I don't think it was necessary for you to tell me that now." And it was filmed, obviously, it was filmed in one take. The squibs, they weren't going to be able to ever rig him up again. Caan said it. Mm-hmm. "I can only do this once." And they knew they had one shot to get it, and it really was brilliantly filmed. Very much inspired by some of the scenes that Coppola described, that he filmed this scene with two directors in mind. Akira Kurosawa, who was really the father of violent films in Japan, who, if you take a look at some of the stuff that he did with squib work, it really was far ahead of its time. Kurosawa was really, really amazing at being able to do scenes like this. But mostly it was modeled after the death scene in Bonnie and Clyde by Arthur Penn, who had done this with the squib work and really was the first to show a violent killing on screen. If you take a look at a lot of the old school movies and a lot of the old gangster movies, when these guys were shot, there wasn't even a splatter of blood. They were just shot. They fell to the ground.
And you saw a trickle of blood on their white shirt.
Yeah, you might see a little bit, and even sometimes that wouldn't pass the
earlier true.
Versions of these movies. A lot of times that didn't even pass the muster test for the censors. So Sonny is brutally gunned down. His bodyguards show up late. Well, I tell you, it's a good thing they were there to help. They showed up after everything was done and over with. But there is a part of this movie that really foreshadows what this really meant, and that's right before the hitmen take off. One of the hitmen rears back and kicks Sonny in the face, and it's meant to disfigure him even more, but it's also meant as an insult, and that's a hint to the audience of who set this up. Because if you recall in the earlier scene when Sonny beat the hell out of Carlo, one of the things that he did was kick him in the face. And that was, if you read the novel, that was one of the prerequisites of Carlo setting up Sonny. "I want him kicked in the face. I don't care what you have to do, but kick him in the face before you leave him." And that was really the foreshadowing for the audience of who was behind this brutal murder. In one of the most touching scenes in the movie, a transition, you see Sonny's dead body lying in the gutter of the causeway, and he's mutilated beyond belief. And it transitions to Tom Hagen sitting alone in the room, having a drink, waiting to go upstairs to get the courage to tell Don Corleone that his son has been brutally murdered. And you see Vito walking down the stairs, and he's, you know, he's kind of hunched over, and he's still convalescing, but he's much better than he was when the last time we saw him. And he sits down, and he knows that something's on Tom's mind. And I think brilliantly played by Duvall here. I think really you take a look at the I don't think he could have done this any better. It fit the character. It fit the mood. He wasn't sobbing uncontrollably. He wasn't just an absolute wreck. Don't forget, he was the closest to Sonny. Sonny was the one that took him in. Tom Hagen is taking this very, very hard with the murder, probably harder than he would have for the death of any other brother in this film. Sonny was someone that he really looked to as his protector, and he has to be the one to deliver the news to the Godfather. Brando is looking at him, and he says, you know, what's wrong? And Hagen looks back at him, and with tears in his eyes and a little bit of a choke in his throat, he looks at him and says, they shot Sonny on the causeway, and he's dead. And Brando acts this perfectly as well, just a sigh of resignation. And you can see he's on the verge of tears, but he's not going to break down, and he's not going to break who he is. He tells him, matter of fact, that he wants him to contact the Undertaker, and that he wants an inquiry made to the heads of the five families, and this stops now. Because he also realizes at this moment, Vito meaning, that his death, that Sonny's death, could mean the death of Michael. And that's something he is not going to take the chance of.
Right.
He may have lost Sonny. He resigned himself to the fact that this was something that could have happened, but he is not going to lose Michael, and he wants the heads of the five families to know that right now. So they do transition to this, and in a scene where, you know, the Don, and I don't want to go into every nook and cranny, because we are going down that rabbit hole that we went towards the last time, my friend, but a brilliantly acted scene where Marlon Brando is looking over the dead body of his son, and he just sees the brutality of how terrible the murder was, and he just looks at him and says, "Look how they massacred my boy." Just really, really well acted by Brando. And later, Duvall would say that he was so in awe of Brando, who was actually laughing and joking around and eating a actual container of squid that he got from a local restaurant where they were filming this movie. And he actually had the container in his hand while they were filming this. You don't see it, but he does. And just he looked like he was so unprepared for this scene. And then when Coppola said, you know, action, he just turned into this grieving father that was just, and that's one thing that Robert Duvall had said.
Wow.
He found a newfound respect for Marlon Brando that day when he filmed that scene. It was just phenomenal and remarkable. But at this point, word now has gotten back to Michael, Don Tomasino, in the cut back to Sicily, and word has gotten back to Michael in Sicily that his brother has been brutally murdered. He is now the husband of Apollonia, and Michael realizes now that his life is in danger as well, and the only thing that can be safe for him is to really move her back to America. And Don Tomasino says, we're going to move you to the village of Siracusa, which is actually where the Sicilian scenes were filmed. Corleone was already too industrialized and too modernized for this to be filmed and be realistic to the time period. So they filmed in Siracusa, which was a little bit more old school at that point. And that's so the nod to Siracusa in is not just something that they pulled out of thin air. That's where they had to film. So they put that name in there as a result of that. And you see Michael preparing. He's preparing to head to Siracusa with his wife, and it's implied that from Siracusa they'll make arrangements to bring them to the United States. And Michael is ready to do that. He goes, you know, toward the car, and Apollonia, as he's been teaching her to drive, and she wants to surprise him by driving to him and driving him to Siracusa and show what a good driver she is. And Michael looks at his bodyguard and says, Fabrizio, dove vai? And Fabrizio looks at him with a look of treachery, and he looks at Michael, these two eyes locked. He runs off as a coward, and now you know exactly what's coming.
Yep.
And you know, Pacino doesn't even get it out of his mouth. Michael doesn't even get out of Apollonia, watch out, and the car explodes. And Michael's wife has been murdered in a bomb that was meant for Michael.
Right.
No question about it. But they feel that they've weakened him enough to that point where his wife was the one that had to suffer death at that point. And at that moment, you really, really feel for the character of Michael. You feel for the character of Apollonia, but you really realize what's about to come. And that was the moment where Michael became hardened and he became paranoid. And from that moment on, Michael would never trust or really fully love anyone ever again. At that moment, his life was all about revenge, and it was all about getting even for the wrongs that were done to him. And I think that is the turning point in Michael's life. And Murph, I've been going on and on about some of these scenes here. I've always felt that that was the turning point in Michael's life. Do you agree with that?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Oh, it's okay. No problem. What I was saying is this scene to me has always been the transition, I think, and the turning point in Michael's life. This is what hardened him.
Oh, yeah.
And really made him the character that we saw in the subsequent movies, really right up until the latter part of part three, where we start to see a softening of Michael and a return to the way he was in the early part of the original Godfather. This really, I think, hardened him to the point where he did not really fully love or trust anybody ever again. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think this is one of those scenes that you always look back in the saga of the Godfather and wonder how this happened. Do you agree with that? Do you think that this was the turning point in Michael's life?
Yeah, it really was. It was the moment that he realized that if he trusts anyone, I mean, Fabrizio is his closest friend there, one of his two closest friends there. You can't trust anyone in this life, in this business,
right?
Because there's always there's always the devil sitting on their shoulder offering
right.
them more or what they
right.
want. Again, we go back to so many different genres in this life that you pay your people enough so they don't want more, but they're still hungry. Fabrizio wanted more. He wanted to be the one to go back to America, and
right.
Barzini, his family offered him that. You take care of this for us, and we will set you up in America. And that's that was the payoff for him to kill Michael. And
right.
at that point, Michael realized that there is nobody outside of your family that you can trust.
Right. Absolutely.
And that plays out more and more in this film, and of course in two, when he tells his brother, you know, he becomes his father here, Sonny. Sonny, his father had told Sonny, you know, never tell anybody outside of the family what you're thinking, ever. And Michael
right.
mirrors that in two, in talking to his brother and Mo when they're talking about Mo Green. Don't take sides against the family. The family is the all. It is the only people that you can trust are named Corleone.
Yeah, it truly is. And that's essentially how the movie transitions. We look back to it right after Apollonia's murder. The scene transitions to a meeting with the Godfather, who is
yep.
in ailing health, but still healthy enough to command some respect in the room. And he's meeting with the heads of the five families. That's when we meet Don Barzini, who we only saw in the opening, wedding scene, just, you know, being there with, didn't have any dialogue. The late Richard Conte plays Don Barzini, and really a great character actor of his time. This was a big role for him, and he was a relatively well-known, he was actually more well-known than a lot of the guys that were in The Godfather.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, he's kind of an afterthought now.
If you look
Richard
down
Conte
at this movie, the
yep.
small character parts are played by much bigger actors than were cast as the main characters of this film.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yep, they truly, truly were. And, and the Don is basically trying to negotiate now with, he's trying to negotiate a ceasefire with this, you know, group of heads of the five families, and he wants to do it to protect his son. And he even says it in the in the closing, in his closing soliloquy in that movie, or in that scene, I should say, where everybody's going around the table and they're talking about the drug business. And Don Corleone was so against being able to bring his family into this. But they resigned the fact that this is the wave of the future. This is how things are going to be. And he really realizes at this meeting that Barzini controlled Tattaglia. He controlled Cuneo. He controlled all of these Stracci, and he controlled all of these guys that were sitting at the table. And the Don in the car when he had left, and Tom Hagen is trying to prep him for some of the things that are about to come. He realizes it, and he names Barzini as his main nemesis, and he knew that. And at this point, Michael has had arrangements to bring Michael back safely. That was part of the agreement that he had to make. It was a point of weakness for him. You want Michael to be okay. You want us to bring. You want to be able to bring your son back. We're going to kill him unless you do what you want us to do. And the Don had no choice. He was that committed to saving the life of his son that he would do something that he originally had absolutely despised to do. And he does. Michael comes back. You see Michael in a much more hardened,
worldly,
stoic, and reasonable Michael than you saw, where he had a little bit more of, it was never really a fun-loving character, but you saw a side to him that had a warmth to it. There's really no warmth to the Michael character when he comes back.
No.
Even in his dealings where he tracks down Kay and realizes, I need a wife and a family to carry on my name. It's almost like, well, Apollonia's not here. I need to find Kay, and if Kay's available, I'm going to do everything that I can to make her my wife. But you almost get the impression that it's more done for business than it is for actual love. And I think there was always a love between the Michael and the Kay characters. There's no question about it. She was always the love of his life. But at this point, Michael was so hardened and so disillusioned by life that he didn't even feel that love for her anymore. This was business more than it was actual love. Whereas you can still see the love that Kay had for Michael when he shows up, and you see the two of them and how hurt she was by how he had treated her and how things had happened between them. And Michael, being the ever prominent businessman, was able to convince Kay that, no, this is not how it's going to be in the future. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be the man that you want me to believe. Right. I'm going to make
my
this
father's
family
ways
legitimate.
Of doing things are over.
Exactly. I'm going to, in 5 years, the Corleone family is going to be completely legitimate, which is a line that comes back to haunt him in part two. Mm-hmm. We won't get into that right now. But Michael essentially settles into life as the Don. But he's a much lesser Don than his father was, at least for the time being, because at that point, Tattaglia and Barzini have much more clout in the New York families than the Corleone family does have at that point, which was never the case. The Corleone family was always the gold standard. They were always the highest level of, they were the last word, essentially. And now their position has been severely, severely weakened to the point where guys like Clemenza and Fessio are questioning Michael's leadership. It doesn't seem like he's doing anything to better the cause of the family. But Michael's got a plan in his mind, and he's playing it out. He's asking the guys that are around him to trust him in his business. And one of them does, one of them doesn't. We'll get into that in a second. But basically, you can see the Don as being he's more and more removed and just more and more detached from the family business. He's aging. He knows he probably doesn't have long to live. His health is failing. And he's transitioning that leadership to Michael. But there's still such a disdain for having to transition this to Michael for him that he doesn't fully want to admit that Michael has to take the reins of the family. He still wants to maintain a little bit of that control to make it seem like I didn't dump all of this on my son's shoulders. Yep. And we really see that in the scene with Michael and his father in the garden, right before the Don passes away. And I think this, to me, is the most poignant scene. It's really my favorite scene in all of movies, where Michael and his father are talking in the garden about how the Don never wanted this for him. And he wanted him to be a senator. He wanted him to be a governor. He wanted him to be someone, another Pezzo Novanta. And there's also a part of the Don that's still hanging on to the reins where he's saying, don't forget, this guy is going to come to you as a, you know, check all the phone records. He's still trying to give and impart wisdom to make it seem like he hasn't entrusted all of this onto Michael and hasn't given it completely to him. One of the best scenes I ever, I could go on and on about this scene because that's how much I love it. This really, I think, is the passing of the torch. I think it really is not just the symbolic passing of the torch, but I really do believe this is the moment where the Don relinquishes control to Michael and puts it completely in his hands, despite of the fact that he never wanted to do it. This is the scene where Michael becomes the Godfather.
Yeah, you can see the pain on the Godfather's face in handing this over. He knew this was going to be Sonny's life, and you know he had already resigned himself to the fact that it wasn't Fredo wasn't going to be able to do this. And it really pained him that this was going on. But Michael had convinced him in these talks that they were having that we don't see that he does have a plan. He is going to make this family legitimate in the way that his father probably wanted to do. His father wasn't involved in drugs. He wasn't involved in human trafficking the way, you know, Tattaglia, the pimp, was. And, you know, he already wanted to hand the reins to Michael as a, you know, as the head of an empire, not the head of a mafia family. And that went out the window. And Michael, but he knew that Michael was going to see his dream through, that he had a plan, and moving out west was part of his plan, and that Tessio and Clemenza needed to trust Michael.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see elements of that where in the scene where Michael is now sitting in his father's chair, he's the head of this family, and he is the one that's responsible for its, you know, survival. He's the one that's responsible for all of it. And that, to me, is really, really, I think, a very big, I think it's a very, very big moment for the both of them. Because what it does is it really, I think, gives light to a lot of what is about to come. And you see the characters of Clemenza and Tessio trying to make sense of what, you know, the Godfather has done here. And how could you turn this scene over to Michael? And basically, you know, you're still alive, Godfather. They're still going to him. And the Godfather is trying to tell them, no, Michael is the head of the family now. And it's almost like they try to set you up for a little bit of trickery, because it almost looks like Tessio is the man that really trusts Michael a little bit more, and Clemenza is more of the hot-headed guy that can easily be influenced, and it's actually the other way around. It really is actually the other way around. In the interest of time, we'll try to kind of, you know, bring all this together in a method that I think is going to be good for everyone to do that. The Godfather, Vito Corleone, essentially passes on, and he passes away very shortly after handing the reins over to Michael and then telling him that, you know, he needs to watch out for traitors that are lining up, you know, against him, that Barzini and the Tattaglia family are going to come after him. They're going to come after him with everything they've got. And at this point, the Godfather does pass away. This is a scene that was, and you touched on this earlier, Murph, this is a scene that was very much ad-libbed. The Don, were played by Marlon Brando, couldn't get the child to play with him. That's why Michael's son's name was actually Anthony in this movie. He's playing with his grandson in the garden. And originally in the novel, his name was not Anthony, but he ends up being Anthony in this because the little kid was named Anthony, and it was the only way that they could get him to respond was by his own name. So Michael's son was named Anthony for that reason. And the Don is trying to play with him. He puts the orange wedge in his mouth, and he's making, you know, trying to chase him around. And the Godfather keels over in the garden, and he is now gone. And Michael has now lost another piece of his life. He's lost his wife, he's lost his brother, and now he's lost his father. And now it's upon Michael to take on the mantle of the family. And with the Godfather out of the way, it's like Kappa regimes now have to mobilize, and they have to find out where their future is going to be. Without the Godfather, they don't believe that Michael has the vision or the guts, really, to be the leader
or
that
the
his father was. Exactly.
You know, he didn't put the time in. It's not like Sonny, you know. Sonny grew up in the family business. Michael didn't. Michael was, you know, Joe College.
Exactly. And not only was he Joe College, but he was also someone that they believed was not capable of being able to think the way gangsters think. You know, Michael was more of a reasonable type person. He was more business minded in terms of the white collar, method of business rather than the blue collar method of business, where his father was a very shrewd and very astute businessman, but a different way. And you actually do see, though, that to me, this is really a lesson in the two Kappa regimes. Tessio being, and Michael says it to Tessio, where he says to Tom about Tessio, it was the smart move. Tessio was always smarter. Tessio recognizes that Michael is not going to be the guy that he believes he can be. He has him completely pegged wrong, but at the same time, he doesn't, you know, believe that that's the case, and he sells Michael out to Barzini. And says, "I'll help you. Set me up with a family. Give me what I want, and I'll make sure that I lead
what
Michael
the last conversation they might have had, his father warned him of.
Exactly. Don't forget the person that comes to you with this Barzini meeting. He's the traitor. And it almost looks like Clemenza is the guy that would be more easily susceptible to that. But Clemenza is actually more emotionally tied to the Corleones than Tessio is. And it's that emotion and that love that he had for the Don and for his children that prevented him from betraying him. Because I think they probably both thought the same way. I think both Tessio and Clemenza had a lot of doubts about whether or not Michael was going to be able to do that. I don't think Clemenza saw Michael and said, "Nah, this kid's smarter than I think he is." But I think it was out of pure loyalty that Clemenza just did not, sell out Michael to the Barzini family. Whereas Tessio looked at it from more of a business perspective and just said that this is the way it has to be. Michael is very calm at his father's funeral, and he's very calculated. Doesn't show a whole lot of emotion, doesn't show a whole lot of fear and a lot of paranoia. He seems like a guy that's very, very much in tune with what he needs to do. And he has a plan in place, and that plan is to eliminate his enemies and eliminate everyone around him. And this is really, I think, something that sticks with Michael all throughout his life. At this point, he realizes that in order to get done what I need to get done, I need to eliminate all of my enemies. And you see that in The Godfather Part 2 as well. I think he just becomes so paranoid with life that he doesn't trust anyone around him, and he wants to eliminate everybody that could be a threat. And he does so in one of the finest film scenes, I think, in movie history. The climax of this movie is just tremendous. It really, really is tremendous. It's a baptism scene where Michael has agreed to become the godfather to Connie and Carlo's baby. And the baptism scene was actually filmed in two churches. The interior shots were filmed at St. Patrick's Old Cathedral in New York City. The exterior shots where Michael was coming out and they're holding the baby and Connie and Carlo and everybody are there, that was actually filmed in Staten Island. That was on Mount Loretto Church in Pleasant Plains. So it was filmed in two different locations, but the internal scene was filmed in St. Patrick's Old Cathedral, and the baby that was baptized in this movie is actually Sofia Coppola,
right?
Who ended up playing Mary in Godfather Part 3, went on to a very good career as a director, not so much as an actress, but we'll get into that in a little bit. But followed in her father's footsteps to a certain point. I don't know if she ever really obtained his level of brilliance, but she is a very, very good director and has gone on to direct several great films. But this was her first film as an infant, but it was her first film. In this scene, it's intercut with Michael standing before the altar, professing to be godfather to Connie and Carlo's baby, but really he's actually professing to be godfather of his mafia family. He's doing that is at the same time as he's standing there professing to be the godfather, he's also ordering the hit of all of the family's enemies, starting with Don Barzini to Don Philip Petalia to Mo Green out in Las Vegas, who Michael offered to buy out from his business that was, really controlling Fredo. He eliminates Mo Green with a bullet through the eye, which really is a nod to how Bugsy Siegel was killed. Cuso really did a great job with this, and Coppola does this phenomenally. But this was well written in the novel as well. I don't want to give all the credit to just the screenplay, which was phenomenal, but Puzo does a great job with alliteration and with a lot of symbolism here as well. So Michael is standing witness as godfather to Connie and Carlo's baby, but he's also consolidating his control in the New York City Mafia and essentially becoming the most powerful of the heads of the five families by eliminating all of the heads. And you see that with Michael. He comes out of the church. He knows exactly what's happened. Al Neri comes up the stairs, just whispers in his ear. Like, basically, you have to assume that he's just saying it's all taken care of, it's all done. And Michael just nods. And it's like, okay, everything's happening according to plan. I've done everything I need to do. But there are still two traitors that have to be dealt with. One of them is Tessio, and the other one is Carlo. And I think he absolutely... Coppola does a great job with filming both of these scenes, where Abe Vigoda just pleading with Tom Hagen, really pleading, dramatic pleading, but just looking at him with a smile. Exactly. Yep. Can you get me off the hook for old time's sake? He almost plays it with a respect, like, I didn't know he had it in him. Like, that son of a bitch, he knew it was me.
He got me.
Almost to, like, the point where if I have to go out, I'm going out because a smarter guy outsmarted me. And it's the complete opposite
of Carlo, you know?
Exactly.
It's the complete opposite.
Where Carlo really is, and it really is the dichotomy between the two characters. Tessio might have been a traitor. He might have been someone that betrayed Michael, but
he was
he's an honorable man, and he's still family, and he's still honorable in terms of the family.
It was just business. I always liked him.
He's on a pedestal here, but there's still an honor to Tessio, and still a toughness and a strength to Tessio that Carlo.
And he wanted Michael to know that it wasn't personal.
To believe that Tom, in his due diligence, probably went back and did tell Michael that, and Michael probably realized it, but he knew that once there was that betrayal that he could not be let off the hook. There was no way that he could do it, whereas Carlo was a coward, and he really shows his true colors. He swears on the life of his kid that he didn't do anything. Just despicable move after despicable move, trying to lie to Michael's face to tell him that, no, I didn't have, I swear to God, I didn't do anything. And Michael just very calmly, very nonchalantly tells him that all of your associates are dead now. You have nothing to lie to me about. I know you did it. Don't lie to me. Tell me what you did. And he lulls him into a false sense of security that if you tell me what you did, I'll let you off the hook. I'm not going to turn my sister into a widow. Meanwhile, he's got Clemenza waiting in the back of the car with the Garrett, but that's okay. We'll get into that in a minute. And he just gets Carlo out of his sight. Carlo is a guy that thought that he had got Michael's trust. Michael had really lulled him in, thinking that when he moved out to Las Vegas, he was going to be his right-hand man. Carlo had really ascended to the top of the family, and he was really feeling it. You can see it. He's wearing
everything he wanted to get accomplished.
Exactly, and he's looking the part, and he's really, doing everything and wearing the hats now, and, he's doing everything to be like mini Michael, basically, which is actually a misnomer, because Johnny Russo is actually a lot taller than Al Pacino. But in that respect, he was like Michael Light, Michael version 2.0. And Carlo is brutally and brilliantly garroted in the car. Once Carlo gets in, Clemenza strangles him. And to me, one of the most poignant scenes in The Godfather is when you see Michael, after he witnesses the death of Carlo, he just turns with Tom Hagen, and with a couple of his guys, I think it's Rocco Lampone and Al Neri, and they walked toward the house, and they walked toward his father's house. And at that moment, Michael is now the Godfather officially. It has, it's not just in his mind, it's not just the resignation that he has. He has now consolidated his power over the heads of the five families, and he's now the man. He is now what his father was. And now it's on his shoulders to be the man that his father was. And we'll get into that when we chronicle The Godfather Part Two. But Michael very coldly continues on. He denies right to not only Connie's face, but also his wife Kay's face,
yep,
that he had anything to do with the deaths of all of the heads of the five families and Carlo. He's moving the family out to Las Vegas, like he said he was going to. They actually end up going to Nevada, to Lake Tahoe, but it's close enough where he's going to do that, and this
right.
is the vision he has for the family. And in one of the more brilliant ending scenes, Michael denies to his wife that he had any type of criminal wrongdoing, and Kay is off to the side, looks like she's fixing herself a drink, and she sees Rocco and Clemenza come in and kiss the ring of her husband, and at that moment, the look of terror on her face, that what have I just married into, what have I gotten myself into here, the door closes, and the coda comes on. And The Godfather, Part One, has come to its conclusion, and after 4 hours of chronicling this, my friend, I mean, we have really, really dissected
yeah.
this movie to its nth degree, but for all of you who downloaded these two episodes, thank you for hanging with us in a really, really difficult, you know, I'm sure, you know, very long, painstaking listen to this, but we hope that you've been able to learn a lot more about the movie than you could ever have before.
Yeah. Exactly. That's what we're here for, and that's what we like to do. And you know, with this movie, it just out of respect, we had to do it in two shows to bring that to you. I mean, in tying it all up, this movie has affected cinema in so many ways, cinema and television in so many ways. You can't really add it all up. You sit here and list how many different inspirations it has spawned, from you know, The Sopranos to The Simpsons, for Christ's sakes, and every mob movie that you've ever seen afterwards, all the ones that we love. The gangster films before this movie were not centered around the Italian Americans and their struggle in the United States to become more Americanized, to become successful in this country, as we said in the first part of this two-part series. But I mean, for good, it was parodied in Saturday Night Live. John Belushi appeared in a skit as Vito Corleone at a therapy session. Does this sound familiar? In a therapy session, expressing his inner feelings about the Tattaglia family. And, you know, he's just to his therapist as to why he hates these people and can't let them go. And he's listing it off. And at the end, he says, yeah, also, they shot my son 56 times, you know, which brings us to, you know, other movies like, oh, God, what was Billy Crystal and The Analyst?
Oh, Analyze This
with
with Robert De Niro, where they parodied the Don's murder scene.
Right. And The Sopranos.
And The Sopranos, where you know, Livia Soprano, the mm-hmm. matriarch of the family, dies, and they essentially recreate the Don's trip down the I can still see it down the elevator, and you know, and then the Undertaker's coming in, and he's saying, "I'm going to use all my powers and all my skills," and Tony, look, all right, let's not get carried away here. Almost stop short. They almost stop short of it, which is great. One of my favorite parodies of this is You've Got Mail with Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, where she's describing her lament of how men are always obsessed with The Godfather, and then he's going on and on about how The Godfather is the answer to all your questions. And, you know,
That's really it.
Just going to the mattresses is one of the part of the pieces of the American lexicon. Leave the gun, take the cannoli. I mean, how many iconic make him an offer he can't refuse? I mean, that line is used so often. I mean, and it's really it's you know, used, I think, maybe more than any other you know, line in this film. But the legacy of The Godfather and the impact that it had on the genre and that it's had on both of our lives, which really I think explains why we've taken so long to explain it, has just been, you know, phenomenal. And it really leads into in my opinion, one of the extremely, extremely few movies that has a sequel that could really live up to the hype of the original. And The Godfather Part II certainly, certainly does that. We can't wait to get into that
right.
one. For the time
whenever,
being,
whenever you
friend,
hear a poll, whenever you hear a poll about the best sequels of all time, people
yeah.
always put in there, excluding The Godfather Part II. Because
exactly.
it's just not fair. It's
yeah,
just not
because
fair.
It's almost seen like just an extension of the,
right.
the original. People don't even look at it as a movie sequel. They just look at it as a continuation of the telling of the story, the tragic telling of the story of the Corleone family, and really the story of Michael Corleone, which I think, and we'll get into this the next time, I think is really a... I think it's really a metaphor for what America went through at the time when The Godfather was released in the early 70s with the transition from, a period of sort of like an era of good feelings to a period of really paranoia among a lot of Americans with authority figures. And you see Michael really be that type of a figure. But
yep.
for the time being, my friend, I think the electricity on the bar is about to be shut off. I think we've definitely, I think we've definitely overstayed our welcome after Shea Biffy tonight. But we do appreciate everybody hanging in there with us. And please, by all means, let us know. We are going to take a little Godfather break and probably a couple of week break for the Shea Biffy. But Murph,
we'll do something next time. Let's do something a little more lighthearted that we can just have fun and get in and out of in under an hour. So
yeah,
what do you say
exactly.
we do the actually do the Freshman?
I think so. I think that's a great
right.
transition and really a great parody of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew Broderick and Marlon Brando really were, I think, a better combination on screen than a lot of people give it credit for. So stay tuned for The Freshman. In the meantime, Murph, where can everybody, all our fans of the Shea Biffy Mob Pod, find you on social media?
Oh, folks, you can find me on social media at TMurph207. From there, you can check out the other podcasts that I do, all the writing that I do, and, just hang out and have a good time. What about you, Mike?
You can find me on Twitter at MDABATEFTC. You can also find me on my content and the content of a lot of our great writers with NFL content at fullpresscoverage.com. You can always find me sitting next to this fine gentleman here on the Shea Biffy Mob Pod, which is available on iTunes. It's available on the Google App Store as well. So be sure to download us, take us with you, and we would love to hear, absolutely, and we would love to hear. And we would love to hear some feedback on this as well. So on behalf of my good friend Murph, I am Mike DeBate, wishing you a fond adieu from the Shea Biffy Mob Pod. Thank you for joining us today, and now you can leave.